Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I am joined by Chris Whalen of Whalen Global Advisors. Chris, good to see you. How are you?
I am very well. Happy spring.
Happy spring, Chris. You are an excellent expert on the banking system. And as we sit here in the middle of April, many of the large U.S. banks, JP Morgan, Citi, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, have already reported their results for the first quarter of this year. What have you thought of the results, and what broad conclusions have you drawn from the results that have come public?
Well, I think it's kind of what we've talked about earlier and predicted, really, which is that interest income is flat to down the way it's been for 6-7 quarters now. This is the adjustment from COVID, and it's continuing. The first quarter tends to be good in terms of fee income and other inputs, and it is. It's not quite as good as a year ago, but it helped. So in the case of Citi and Bank of America, both the traders and the investment side came to the rescue. But the real weakness for all of these banks to one degree or another is return on earning assets. In other words, what do they make on interest rates? And people keep making the mistake of implying that rates are going to one way or another affect bank earnings. It's really about spreads. And spreads are still kind of a mess across all of these markets. And it's been hard for people to hedge, hard for them to predict what to do. So in the first quarter, for example, we had a rally. If you start from October, really to the end of the quarter, rates fell. Mortgage rates fell a point and a quarter. So people made more loans at lower coupons, and they generated a lot of fees. So that's why that fee number looked better. But now we're looking at higher for longer, and I think the street's going to have to adjust accordingly, Bank of America particularly. You know, I just did a note on Bank of America and Schwab. Good news on Bank of America is that, you know, they did okay on the trading side, but they're still getting killed on interest rates. Their securities portfolio is less than 3% average yield. It's $840 billion, Jack. That's a third of the bank. So I think all of these banks still have an interest rate problem that we kind of forgot because we had the rate rally. But if we go back to a 5% 10-year treasury, then we have a problem again in terms of mark-to-market. And at the same time, we're kind of worried a little bit about consumer, but it's still okay. The charge-offs really aren't that high. Commercial is still where the action is, unfortunately. And you're going to continue to see a procession of idiosyncratic announcements about commercial real estate. It's hard to, you know, make a generalization about them, really. But that's going to be the story this year is commercial. Consumers next year. That's my kind of takeaway from this.
So there's two types of banking, commercial banking, yes, old school style banking, and investment banking.
Exactly.
The investment banking is doing deals, issuing securities, taking a fee from the proceeds.
Yes.
Old school banking is a lot of what you focus on. And when you had a critique or you had a worry about the banking system that net interest income would be flat to down, that is what you were talking about, that the difference between what banks earn on their loans and what they pay on deposits, that spread, net interest margin, that is narrowing. And that concern that you've had, Chris, is it fair to say that it has played out as you've expected?
Yeah, sadly, it doesn't give me any pleasure because, you know, basically the banks are getting squeezed between the cost of funds. It's going higher slowly. It has decelerated. That's the good news. But because we just had a rate rally, and because you had a lot of issuers going to the bond market in the first quarter, it was quite competitive. So the return on those assets is not as high as people think. You always hear people say, oh, well, you know, interest rates are up. It's going to help bank earnings. No, it depends on what's out there in the marketplace that they can originate and retain in portfolio or sell. Either way, they make money on it. But the point is that what are investors paying? Private equity investors, everybody who competes with Jamie Dimon for assets, right? Well, they're willing to take a lower return to capture the asset. You see this constantly. You see, Jack, people taking commercial real estate assets in this country for, you know, big investment portfolios, and they're going a point below the market in terms of coupon to capture the asset. Now, obviously, the issuers, the buildings, the developers are still in shock because of where interest rates are. You know, think about it. Your rates are up 5 points from the lows of COVID, 6 points. What does that mean? It means that investors have expectations of returns that are higher. That means the cap rate on your building is not a 2 or a 4, it's a 6 or an 8. And if the net income of the building hasn't changed, guess what? The value is down. So that's the environment people are operating in right now in commercial. So refinancing assets, doing new deals, it's a different world. You know, you have to pay for money now. And that's the real impression I get with, you know, from my colleagues on the commercial side. They're worried about tenants. Tenant turnover in buildings is probably the single biggest diligence item when somebody's looking at an acquisition of a major asset. They go talk to the tenants. I'm totally serious. They'll go talk to all of them.
Bank lenders before they lend to a project.
Yeah, or an investor who wants to buy the building. Okay. You know, the change in behavior on the part of tenants is so profound. And the expectation that investors have that so-and-so is going to save money on space, right? On occupancy costs. Everybody has to do it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So when you're looking at an office building, your assumption is that half of the tenants are going to downsize or leave. That affects valuation very much.
Right. So we talk about commercial real estate. There's offices and not offices, apartment buildings and other projects.
They're all different. You know, let me tell you a funny one that'll give you a kick. I went to Villanova, okay? King of Prussia Mall is fully let. 100%, okay? They're doing fine. People like driving to the mall in Pennsylvania. Well, how many other stories do we have that are totally the opposite of that? So it just shows you location, location, right?
Yes, it's idiosyncratic. I mean, I'm sure you've heard stories like this, many more about, you know, they buy a mall project for $50 million and their equity was wiped out and the mall is sold for $180,000 in auction. Those things happen, but it's only if they happen all at the same time that there's a systemic event. So, and it's fair to say, Chris, that the large U.S. banks, JP Morgan, Bank of America, do not have large exposures to U.S. commercial real estate loans, let alone offices. You know, offices is a small sector of the CRE pie. A lot of the banks that have exposure are, for example, a bank that you actually like Bank of the Ozarks, regional banks, not the JP Morgans. That's fair to say, right?
No, I think people get that wrong. We wrote about it. The big banks have large exposures. It's just that they're only half bank. You know, Jamie and Bank of America are half investments in capital markets and half bank. So if you look at the numbers, you know, Bill Moreland at Bank Reg Data is great on this. They actually have large exposures. Bank of the Ozarks is different because it's not commercial real estate. He's doing construction and development. So he's getting in there in the beginning of the life cycle of that asset, financing its creation. And then he's getting out on the expectation that another bank is standing there with a 7 to 10 year mortgage. That's a different business. And yes, people treat him as a bellwether for commercial real estate. That's absolutely right. But I also think it's mistaken because he's not the kind of guy who's going to sit there and hold this stuff. These are short duration assets. And time, as you know, is risk. So I think he's got the right idea. He does new RVs, new autos, and those are all new assets. Good. You know, it's a different kind of business than financing commercial properties with a mortgage. Okay. That's different because you own the risk. You know, if you're the lender, you better talk to the tenants. Oh, yeah. You know who taught me that? Dale Hemmerdinger. He passed away a little after COVID. Great guy. Former chairman of the MTA, big commercial developer in New York. He said, I talk to my tenants every day. And that's why.
Chris, is it commercial real estate for exposure as a percentage of the loans? Even on the loans are not big. So like I'm looking at Bank of America. They've got $72 billion of real estate loans, commercial real estate loans, out of a trillion on loans and leases, so 7%, and then offices are 17%. So if 2% of your loans are office loans, it can't be that big.
No, it's not his specialty. It's not their sweet spot. They're mostly consumer small business. They're a huge small business lender, Bank of America. They don't, you know, they're not particularly competitive. If you look at their spreads on their loans, they do okay. So they're not going to go out there and compete with the MetLifes and the and Wells, for example, who's a huge player in that market, or Truist. They love that stuff. And, you know, like I say, it depends. But all of them have exposure. Don't kid yourself. And they're all slow walking these exposures the same way we have been with consumers. You know, what have we done with consumers since COVID? We modify the loan. In fact, we'll modify the loan 3 and 4 times. They don't even buy the loan out of the pool anymore. They leave it in the pool and they advance the interest and the principal.
Which type of loans?
Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Agency mortgages. This is a different world. Since COVID, we have institutionalized loan modification. So whether you're talking about commercial loans to commercial real estate, which, you know, you'll see is interest only. Interest only used to be okay when the asset prices were going up every year. But now, in a market where asset prices are falling, as you were just saying, right, that doesn't work. So when people see those two words, interest only and disclosure, they freak out with the banks because they assume that those are modified loans and the obligor is essentially on their way to default. So that's what we're dealing with here. You have a certain degree of opacity in the disclosure coming from these banks, and it's hard to tell exactly what's going on. And so we will have more surprises like we saw with New York Community Bank. They're just going to say, oh, you know, restatement, sorry. And that's why, by the way, in our bank index, we amended our methodology document so that if you become not timely or you drop a restatement, you're out of the index same day. Boom. Goodbye.
Boom. That's good. So New York Community Bank would be an example of a regional bank that had heavy exposures to commercial real estate, much heavier
and
than
multifamily. Multifamily in a lot of ways is worse, Jack, because the loss rates normalized actually in 2021 and never recovered. So they're still up around 100% loss on multifamily defaults right now.
What do you mean a loss rate?
I mean, that's how much of the loan you're losing upon default.
Oh, okay. Recovery.
Yeah. You can lose more than 100%, by the way.
How?
Because let's say the building goes bad. You write down the loan, but you're still the owner. You foreclosed on the building. You took it over as the bank, right? The city may not let you abandon it. You may go to New York City and say, here's the keys. Thank you. And they may say, no, you have to keep it and maintain it until you get rid of it, right? That's what's so interesting about Signature. You know, FDIC came out with this report that said, oh, we got to resolve big banks without loss to the taxpayer, right? But meanwhile, they didn't sell all the assets from that bank. They shouldn't have shut it down. They should have put it in conservatorship because it was idiosyncratic, to say the least. And now they have assets they can't sell. And Marty Gruenberg is going to hide these multifamily buildings in the FDIC Bank Insurance Fund. He's just going to keep them. And I assume they're going to have to bear the expense of taking care of the buildings. So this is a mess. This whole asset class, because of a lot of politics, really has been impaired, especially in states like California and New York. You know, rent control real estate is a big problem for banks now.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview. And so the narrative, Chris, was that the issues in commercial real estate, which include office buildings, multifamily, also known as apartment buildings, hospitals, malls, so many other industrial warehouses, was mainly limited to offices for the well-known issue of work from home. I believe you and I are both recording this from our home. But and the issue, you know, multifamily apartment buildings, the fundamentals there looked phenomenal because, you know, rents were going up 10% a year. And
they had been for a century.
the occupancy were very high. Everyone wanted apartment buildings. There was a shortage of apartments, a shortage of housing. So this New York Community Bank thing took me by surprise. Is the issue because of rent control?
Well, somewhat, but I think New York Community Bank was just a case where they mishandled the delivery of information to the markets and to investors. The book itself, I think people kind of knew what was going on with the bank's portfolio. We knew what New York Community Bank was. And people like me, I think we were hoping that the Flagstar team was going to kind of shake things up a little bit. They had run a national mortgage business and they had offices all over the country. So, it was a merger of cultures. And unfortunately, the comfortable New York culture that assumed that these assets were money good always, Jack, did not comport with the reality of politics, which is in 2019, the state legislature in New York basically passed a law that said you couldn't recover expenses on renovating apartments. So, a developer's got to spend $150,000 to bring an old apartment up to code. It costs the city of New York twice that much, by the way, for public housing. So it's a mess. And lending on that stuff is very hard if you can't at least see the building recover their costs, because that means the building won't be profitable over time. No bank wants to hold an asset like that. And the regulators have already told the banks not to finance these assets. So it's a problem. We have a political issue that has taken what used to be a gold asset that everybody wanted in a personal portfolio. Small and mid-sized business people in New York would buy apartments. They loved them. They were always fully let. Queens, look at all of Queens and Brooklyn and the Bronx. So, that's what's going on there. And it's going to be tough for banks. You're going to be reading about this for the next couple of years.
And the issue is, not to oversimplify it, but just that real estate developers who have loans on rent-controlled properties, They couldn't raise rents enough to cover the surge in their interest expense.
Well, that was the other thing. Yeah, we're repricing assets. So that on top of everything else, let's put it this way. Imagine you're sitting there talking to the bank, and the bank says, well, the value of the building's come down 20%, Chris. It's fully let, but I can't sell it for what I paid for. The price has come down. You've got to put more cash in if you want to keep the loan. Well, how many developers are going to do that after losing money for 2 years during COVID? Because none of the politicians thought about that. They were too busy taking care of the consumers. Consumers since COVID, Jack, have become toxic, both for regulatory reasons and because they're not really reliable as a source of funding for a bank.
What do you mean consumers?
Yeah. The banks would rather issue term debt to institutional investors than have deposits. You see that with Schwab. Schwab is slowly issuing long-term debt. It's more expensive, but it's okay because their cost of funds is still half of the average for large banks. That is a very interesting change in the model that I think we're going to see expand over time. I think you're going to see many of these banks try and minimize the amount of consumer deposits that they have for regulatory reasons, for economic and financial reasons. It's just fascinating.
Regulatory reasons. That's interesting because banks relied on wholesale funding, basically funding from other institutional investors who would pull their money, from Bear Stearns at the drop of the hat, from Lehman Brothers. And the idea is that consumer deposits are, if I'm at work all day, I'm not reading about an arcane bank issue that is going to cause me to do
it. But you have a smartphone. Yeah. And your wife or husband can call you and say, hey, so-and-so's in the news. That's what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. That's why 40% of their deposits walked out the door in a week. That's what the regulators are worried about when it comes to consumers. And again, isn't this interesting? I almost think that eventually they're going to have to put hard gates in place to prevent people from moving money short term, to kind of force them to cool off and think about it. Because when people act impulsively out of fear, that's a very difficult thing to get ahead of. That's why we used to have stops on, stock trading. When there wasn't sufficient information, they would halt the stock. So I think, in the age of the smartphone, we may be very quickly arriving to that conclusion, because otherwise, why would I want consumer deposits, Jack? Time deposits, okay. But I wouldn't want money market deposits. Hell no.
Because they're a lot cheaper.
they're cheaper, but they're very fickle.
Yeah.
I feel better about broker deposits. I'm actually buying from a professional.
But isn't the beta, the deposit beta of broker deposits much, much, in other words, they're more expensive as interest rates rise.
Yes.
Why not just have consumer deposits? And if they leave, then you can replace them with broker deposits.
Well, that's what people were forced to do.
Yeah.
But again, the behavioral change that people are dealing with in so many areas is really quite impressive. You're seeing big changes in the balance sheets of these banks. They're not going to look anything like they looked before COVID.
And their liabilities, i.e. their deposits, change much more rapidly than their assets. I know. So, Bank of America actually had some interesting repricing on some securities portfolio, but Schwab, which I know you've actually been a fan of, and a lot of people, mm-hmm. myself included, have been a little skeptical of Schwab's, which, like Bank of America, has tons and tons of low-yielding assets. I think you were right in that Schwab's deposit franchise, they just have such cheap deposits that they can maintain their net interest margin.
Need them.
But interestingly, their securities book had literally the exact same yields as a year ago. 2.12% in March 2023 to 2.12. They're literally not even going up a basis point. So these things are just there for, not eternity, but effective eternity.
I mean, they're half of Brian Moynihan's cost of funds. And since they don't take any credit risk and they don't really have any expense as a result for provisions, it's like a big hedge fund that has this enormous broker-dealer attached. You know, if you remember that the broker-dealer is the point of this conversation at Schwab, well, the rest of it, they let the bank get too big. They got some headlines. And then, you remember 2 years ago, we were talking about this, and I said, nah, they'll get smaller, but they're definitely not going to fail. And people thought I was crazy, but nah, they're doing fine. They're going to get smaller. You watch. They'll get that bank down to $200 billion. It doesn't need to be big and that big to take care of their customers. The rest of it's a trade.
A lot of banks are getting smaller. In fact, I struggle to think of any banks that are expanding.
Listen, right now in this market, when you see the big banks showing excess deposits that are 30, 40, 50% of total, the question is, okay, what are we doing with that money? And the answer is not much. So yes, I don't care if you're Jamie Dimon or Moynihan or any of these guys, they would probably like to be 20% smaller than they are. They would have better equity returns, better liquidity, and they'd be a much more nimble enterprise. I think the mid-sized banks actually are going to do better in this next year than the big guys.
Why?
Better pricing on assets, and they tend to be pretty conservative. They keep everything available for sale, so they have to market to market every quarter. That's a nice old banker discipline. It just says, I'm not holding anything to maturity. Yeah. And that means you keep your treasury very small. It should only be 3-4% of total assets, not 10, not 15. These banks don't need that kind of liquidity. They need access to the home loan bank for their mortgages. They need access to the discount window. If they're big enough, then they'll have correspondent relationships with Jamie or US Bank. And then that pretty much takes care of their needs. Because these guys aren't in the capital markets business. They run on a monthly calendar that says, well, this much money is coming in. We got to lend this much money out. And that's it. So I like the smaller banks. You can see it in our index. We'll be rebalancing at the end of this month once the disclosure's in on the first quarter. And, if you look at that group, it's pretty solid, anything from about 20 billion up. Tend to be pretty good performers. They have good equity returns and they have much better pricing on their loans. Everybody owns the same securities. The real issue with different banks is, are you paying attention? In other words, in 21, were you selling those low coupons and buying T-bills, which is what Brian Moynihan should have been doing? And some people did. I mean, if you look at JP, they were taking their lumps every quarter. They were selling it and reinvesting. And because they reinvested it 4 points higher, it made up for the loss. That was the trade. I think when the history of this period's written, Jack, a lot of time is going to be spent on this volatility in rates and what it did to a lot of investors, not just banks, all sorts of investors.
Chris, since October, as interest rates have fallen, I think the bank stocks have been on a tear and they've been rallying alongside other stock markets. And perhaps that's because bank investors are no longer anticipating a recession. And if there goes from a time where bank stocks are pricing into recession to not pricing into recession, that repricing can be quite bullish for bank stocks as it has been. How are you thinking about the value of bank stocks? In other words, has the rally since the lows in October been justified?
Well, you're absolutely right. We did see a remarkable rally, and there were a lot of names that were consumer facing that had been kind of abandoned because people were worried about a recession. Ally, Capital One, Olerosum, Citi was the best performing stock in the first quarter because of the cross cutting. So, you know, there were a lot of managers who jumped in on that assumption, like you say, no recession, soft landing, right? Since then, however, because the inflation numbers have been less than optimal, a lot of people are walking back those rate cut predictions. We're basically back to one this year, maybe in the fourth quarter. They're going to taper the balance sheet, clearly. They're worried about liquidity for the banks. They would like to see deposits continue to grow. But, you know, the big gorilla in the room, I hate to say, is the federal budget deficit. This is going to mess up all of the plans for a soft landing because I think, you know, when they have to refund again, rates are going to go higher. I think we're going to see the 10-year at 5. And the mark-to-market for banks at 5% is pretty brutal. It is. You know, think about the average life of those mortgage-backed securities that a lot of banks still own from 20 and 21. It's 15 years. When those securities came out, the average life was 1 year because they were prepaying so fast. So, you know, that's the difference in the markets today. You know, I would love to tell you that we're going to have higher yields and the banks are going to benefit and be able to bail themselves out of all this. But the competition for those assets continues. So that's what I see going forward. You're going to see loan yields under some pressure, even if rates back up. We did see a lot of market activity in the first quarter. That may cool off. And look at Jefferies, look at Goldman. They both signaled this. They had pretty good quarters. A lot of my lender clients, by the way, made a lot of loans in the first quarter, many more than they were expecting. And the profitability was a bit better. The fourth quarter was horrific. Everybody in mortgages lost money. You know, that's the kind of market it is. People have to get ready for the idea that we're looking at the floor in rates. Think about 4, 4.5 is the max floor in rates going forward. And then we could go much higher. I think that's the new reality that people still are not quite comfortable with.
So, you know, you were right that going from 0 to 5% in a short amount of time was very bad for bank net interest income. But you think basically because, you know, I explained for the audience, deposit costs went up way higher than loan yields because no one wants to get a new mortgage when they had 3% and the mortgage rate's at 7%. But you still think that higher for longer will continue to be bad for banks? Because explain that to me, Chris, because how hasn't most of the pain on the deposit side already been taken?
Yes and no. You have to pay them to stay. And if T-bill rates remain elevated, if you see that 2 and 3 year where it is right now, that's pretty compelling. There are a lot of other assets out there. Look at agencies. I could buy Federal Home Loan Bank a point above treasuries for 1 year. I mean, it's practically a T-bill, right? But it's still trading at a very wide spread. So there are alternatives out there, and the banks have to compete with that. And look, there's one, I think, overlay for the foreseeable future that we have to remember is that those low interest rates were possible because we had savings out there that were looking to be deployed in, you know, risk-free assets. That's not going to be the case. The world is rapidly getting to the point where savings are not nearly as abundant as they were previously. And that low rate environment that Alan Greenspan and his successors had in place at the Fed may not be possible. Because everybody thinks that the Fed controls short-term rates and, you know, maybe the market controls the rest. Maybe not. Maybe the Fed can't push rates down as much as they've done in the past. And that's what I think people are still wrestling with. They're not comfortable with that. So if you're managing a bank, you better be fixated on duration risk is really what it comes down to. Credit risk, I think we're looking at it. I don't expect to see consumers really spike in terms of default. I'm not looking for a huge recession next year. We'll get a housing reset in a few years. If we end up with 7.5% mortgages by the end of this year, which I think is a reality, we're going to be looking at a market that looks a lot like the 1990s. Right. You know, not much going on, low volumes. And that's going to be a different world. Because think about banks. Banks have to often go buy assets to stick on their balance sheet so they can make money. The competition for assets is going to keep yields down. And that's what I think is so interesting. We got to pay for funding. If I issue debt instead of deposits, it's going to cost me a point more, right? You mentioned that earlier. Deposits are cheaper, but they come with risk. They could leave. You know, that's the world I think all of these institutions have to work in. I like Schwab a lot better than Bank of America. Bank of America is my bank, by the way. I am a customer, and I love them dearly. But, you know, oh, my God, they should all be spanked. I'll spank them, you know? I couldn't believe Mike Mayo didn't savage him on the call yesterday.
Like, okay. So Mike Mayo is a bank analyst, well-known bank analyst. Wells Fargo. Brian Moynihan is CEO.
I worked with Mike at Pru. He's a prince. And a very, very serious weightlifter.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Michael's great.
Why do you want to spank the bank CEOs?
Because they were not paying attention. Same thing with Silicon Valley. When the Fed drops interest rates the way that they did during COVID, you kind of sort of knew, I hope, that it was temporary and that you had to manage your balance sheet accordingly. So if I'm making 2% mortgages, all right, I sell them for 104 and I buy T-bills because I know that I'm facing vast duration risk I can't even hedge. That's how radical the move in interest rates was in 2020. For some reason, people were listening to the Fed. Remember, inflation is transitory. Well, of course it's transitory, but so is duration. And when you saw the duration on mortgage-backed securities get cut by 80%, which I didn't even think was possible, by the way, you know it's going to go back the other way. And you have to manage your bank accordingly. Jamie Dimon did this. The guys at Wells did a pretty good job on this. The guys at Citi did a good job, too, because they run a different book. It's very short. And then the Goldman, Morgan Stanley guys, they are all in a different business. They run broker-dealers. So by definition, everything they have is marked to market, and it tends to be very short. They're not going to take long-term market risk. So there were some banks that, unfortunately, tend to have lots of duration, Bank of America. They keep a lot of loans, and they didn't realize the risk that the Fed was creating with those short, very, very violent moves in interest rates. I kind of hope nothing happens for the next few years, Jack. You know, there could be worse things than keeping Fed funds at 5%. Let's give them half a point. We'll get Fed funds down to 5% or maybe a little less. And then they just leave it there. People are making money. I think the big problem is that people who are producing new assets, their cost for warehousing loans before they sell them is still negative. So in other words, they're losing money on their inventory before they can package it up and sell it. And that's tough for lenders. So, you know, if you got Fed funds down into the mid-4s, 4.75, it would actually take a lot of pressure off lenders. It's not like they're making a lot of money on these loans when they sell them.
So you only need a few cuts from the Federal Reserve,
cuts. Give me down to 5.25 first, and then 5 would be enough. You know, people will learn to live with this over time, but it is going to change the way capital moves around, and it's going to change, things like private equity a lot. Leverage for deals now costs real money. So you've got to factor that into the equation. It's really going to change asset allocation dramatically, I think, if we keep rates where they are.
Chris, tell us about private equity and the old world of, you know, banks financing deals and buyouts. That's gone. Now no longer in the high yield bond market either, or leveraged loan market. It's now the private credit market. I mean,
it is and it isn't. Look, when somebody comes in and they're willing to finance a building, for example, a point below where everybody else is willing to do it, you as a bank have a choice. You're either going to chase it and price your asset the same way, or you're going to say, no, thank you, I'm not interested. That's the choice people have because there's still so much liquidity in this market, Jack, that every day, banks, funds, I don't care who you're talking about, insurance companies that are involved in these markets, they have to make that choice because they may be competing with a greater fool who has just decided they have to have that asset. Whether or not that's a good choice or not is another matter. But they want that asset and they're willing to take a lower coupon in order to win it. Well, you as a banker have a choice. You've got to decide whether or not you want to play that game or not. And it goes for the funds too. And the funds are buying distressed assets. They have to make the same choice because they may be competing with people. You see this a lot in mortgage servicing too. Same thing. You'll see a pool that has a certain level of delinquency. A lot of people won't even touch it. And then you have a guy show up who buys the whole thing at a premium price. So, you know, value is in the eye of the beholder. But anyway, I hope that's helpful.
It is. Tell us, you said on the commercials, you said on the consumer side, you were not too worried. What have you made about auto loans and credit card loans where delinquencies are rising, but they still remain historically low?
Yeah, we're not even above 2019 levels. I'd like to see a more sustained, you know, increase before I start sending the alarm. A lot of the banks, if you go through the earnings, Jack, were kind of saying that they were basically done increasing reserves. There were even some reversals. So, you know, it's not like we're staring at this huge recession. I still think there's an awful lot of liquidity in the system. And that's why you haven't seen defaults rise. That may change, but I don't think it'll change this year. That would be another twist in the scenario, wouldn't it?
Yes. And is it fair to say that the rise in delinquencies or defaults among consumer loans has not been a major cost item on bank balance sheets?
Not yet. Yeah.
Compared to interest expense, for example.
I would say credit card, auto have been the biggest consumer issues. Residential mortgage, no.
Not at all, yeah.
And then on the commercial side, multifamily and office. I would say multifamily first, because those tend to be very idiosyncratic. You know, when I saw that loss rate go back to 100%, which is kind of where it had been during the 2008 crisis, I was really surprised. I didn't think it was going to normalize that fast. And part of it was politics in some of the states where we have rent control. But part of it was just the shock, I think, of COVID and how it impacted developers and landlords who didn't get paid for 2 years. The politicians just assume these people have a secret pot of money hidden somewhere, you know, where they can subsidize their existence for 2 years. But that's not the case. You know, all of these are businesses and you have to treat them as such or they won't be there.
You think that the credit risk issue on bank balance sheets are primarily on the commercial real estate side?
This is the theme for 2024 is commercial.
Commercial real estate, even though people have been talking about it for 2 years and we haven't seen any major
long time
blow-ups.
It'll be like the oil patch in Texas in the 70s. Because remember, these situations move glacially slow. They will have, you know, professionals on both sides. You have banks involved. You have REITs. And they'll restructure these deals. They'll extend them. Everybody's hoping for interest rates to fall, of course, right? So it's easy to sell people on a three-year extension on a loan at the same rate. But the trouble is, eventually, you do have to reprice the debt. Because if you keep the old mortgage at the old coupon, right, what's it worth? It's obviously going to trade at a discount. So all of these markets have to normalize over time, Jack. It's just, you know, the way of the world. There's not much you can do about it.
What do you think is going to happen to New York Community Bank, which, you know, this needless to say that the stock price crashed. There's a private equity consortium led by former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who made a bid and bought some preferred equity at a very, very dilutive and very low price. I think the stock price could be trading even lower than that deal is now. What do you think is how it plays out there with NYCB?
You know, my attitude is that they need to raise more capital to deal with the multifamily assets that they own. I think we've got to get the city of New York and the state involved in this situation because all of the similar assets in other banks have the same problem. Eventually, the city's going to end up owning them. So one way or another, we have to have that conversation. And then the key party who's part of all this is the FDIC and Chairman Grunberg, who, as I said before, has just decided to keep the assets a Signature, which he can't sell. There was no real bid out there for 100% of control of these things. So that, you know, to me, if I'm running New York Community Bank, I know they probably got a rebrand as Flagstar, which is great. But I would, you know, be up in Albany pounding the table because this is Albany's problem. This problem was not created by these bankers. When I raided many of these banks in New York City, Jack, when I was at Kroll, these portfolios had never had any defaults. That's how good they had been. And they were constantly let. They had, you know, good records as far as maintenance and upkeep and everything else because they had the money. Now they don't. So when you have a small rent stabilized apartment somewhere, you know, the first thing you ask is not how many of the apartments are let, but, you know, what does the net operating income look like? What does their capital budget look like? Are they putting a new roof on? Do they have to do the exterior envelope of the building and put up the scaffolding and everything else? Operating these assets in New York City, as you can imagine, is very expensive. Any of the services you need to take care of an apartment building in New York City are many times more expensive than up here in Westchester County, you know, 20 miles away. So that's the issue, is that the cost of maintaining assets in New York with all of the politics and the regulation is very high.
Needless to say, you were not bullish on NYCB. Is that fair to say?
Well, it is what it is. I mean, I used to be very positive on the stock, but after the restatement and the rest of it, obviously they've fallen rather dramatically. I think when we rebalance our index, it probably won't even be in the top 100, be my guess. You know, they had really good financial performance. They had great equity returns, very good operating efficiency. So they had initially been in kind of the high 20s when we first published the index in February. But after the restatement, you know, the total return went all the way down to the bottom of the scale. So when I did my update at the end of the month and I was just looking over the group, you know, they had already fallen pretty far. I think it's going to be a work in progress. I think the bank will get bought eventually because, you know, the mortgage business, the servicing business needs a new home.
It needs a new home.
Yeah, you can't get waivers on the investment grade rating forever. They already got waivers from all the agencies, and they're going to have to do something about that.
Chris, thanks so much for joining, and talk soon. Thanks, everyone, for watching. Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/HODLFG to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.